It's Alexis Garbrandt.
Hi, this is Alexis Scarborough on the Dolly Mama, and I have an interview today with someone that I have a lot of respect for. His name is Justin Sinceri, and he is the host of the podcast Stuck Not Broken. It is fabulous. He has great enthusiasm about the polyvagal theory, and I just want to share this information. It's changed the way that I parent myself and the way that I parent my children. So, get ready. This is my first interview ever. I'm really nervous to share this, but I think that Justin did a great job, and I couldn't have done better without his guidance. Enjoy.
Hey, Alexis.
Hello, Justin. How are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm tickled pink to be able to talk to you.
I hope I don't disappoint.
No, I don't think you will. I've been listening for quite a while now and just having my socks blown off by the amount of information I've been absorbing from the podcast, and yeah, and the morphing in my own parenting of my children and of myself with this information, and I just want to share it with the world, and I'm so happy to get this opportunity. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, tell us about you.
Okay, so I am Justin Sinceri. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I am working currently for a public school district, and I'm obsessed with something called the polyvagal theory. I have a podcast that's the polyvagal theory is foundational to the podcast. It's called Stuck Not Broken. And I also do private pay clients at nighttime. So just therapy and the polyvagal theory are kind of my life, besides being a husband and a father as well. But yeah, the podcast, therapy, polyvagal theory, it's my day in, day out.
What brought you to the polyvagal theory?
So the polyvagal theory, what brought me to it, let me explain what it is first. And it is like the easiest way I can explain it is that it is the science of how mammals connect. It's the science of connection, the science of safety, but it's also the science, like the biology of how we respond to danger and how we get stuck in more like defensive behaviors and defensive states. And so it's just like, it's the biology of that. And it has a lot to do with trauma. It has a lot to do with really like day-to-day living as well. But I think trauma is really found a home in the trauma informed space. And what brought me to it was I'm a therapist, and I was working with a client. It was a couple of years ago. I was working with a client, and I was just not happy with the progress that we were making, and heavy history of trauma or traumatic events.
Yeah.
And I wasn't happy with how things were going. I wasn't super content with it, and I just felt like I needed to. There was something I was missing. I just kept feeling like there was something I was missing, and I was doing my best and doing all my therapy things that were helpful with others, but it just wasn't going anywhere. And so, working for the school district, I work during the summers. I see kids during the summers. Usually, they don't want to meet with me. They just want to have their summer away from anything related to school. So that's usually in the summers we'll develop programs and curriculum and professional development and stuff. And so that summer, I spent probably a month, just learning about trauma. And assuming that I just know nothing, I went onto YouTube like any good scholar would, and I just looked up trauma and, you know, like just what comes up, what can I learn? Just assume I know nothing and start from scratch. And I first found somatic experiencing with Peter Levine, and then that led me to the polyvagal theory from Dr. Porges, and I listened to like his lectures, and I just, between the two of those, somatic experiencing and polyvagal theory, I was like, this is what I'm missing. I'm missing this biological, the aspect of it. I'm missing the, you know, understanding where my client in particular, all my clients, but that one in particular, understanding what they were capable of and what was happening in their biology. and what I could bring to the table, how I could do things differently. And it ended up helping a lot with the school district. We don't, once they graduate, we don't get to keep meeting with them. So the student was able to graduate, which is great, but that's, yeah, that's kind of when therapy ended. And there was definitely improvement in a lot of ways, but yeah, that's how it came about. And since I had first learned about it, I've just been pretty much obsessed with learning and applying it in all facets of life.
It's so good.
Yeah.
The one thing that's I've gotten from your information and then from Stephen Porges is that recognizing those stages, that the three stages that we can, or, well, is on also one of them?
I don't think so.
Recognizing, yeah, I think that's probably in the fight or flight area, but just recognizing, like, when my kid is in fight or flight, I was raised in a lot of trauma, so I am also in fight and flight a lot, but recognizing it in my child it almost like flips the table for me, and suddenly I have empathy.
Oh yeah, sure.
Whereas before it was more of just like a get her done. This is irritating. You know? I don't know how to explain, you know, but
I definitely like get it. Well, I don't.
Polyvagal, it's got meat to it now.
It totally does. Yeah.
Our phases. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think it's like all or nothing either. Like I have those moments where I'm hugely empathetic, and there's other moments where it's like, just go to bed, dude. You know, like just go to bed. We do the same thing every night. Yeah. He basically falls asleep at like 9 o'clock every night. His bedtime's 8 o'clock. He's a 5-year-old. He's in bed at 8, but he doesn't fall asleep until 9. And so every night he tries to get up and out of bed and blah, blah, blah. And at some point it's just like, dude, go to bed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mine just don't listen to that. I had actually, as embarrassing as it is, last night I had a break and I was just like, get to bed. And this morning I got a couple of complaints. You were crabby last night.
At least they have the space to complain to you.
Thank you. That is true. Yes.
Well, I don't, you know, like learning the polyvagal stuff is really good to learn the different states, and hopefully we can go into them, but like learning how it relates to our daily life and how we are as parents, that's fantastic. But I think it also, people take it and they sit and they run with it, and it's like, well, I'm not doing good enough and I need to be better and I need to be co-regulating just incessantly and I have to be the safe person at all times, and that's not realistic. I think it's okay for parents to make mistakes. I don't want to encourage parents to yell. Absolutely no hitting, stuff like that. But at the same time, like if you have those moments where you are losing patience and it's just like, go to bed, it's pretty much okay. You're not going to damage your kids, especially if you have lots of empathy and you do have moments of connection. You know, it's not all or nothing, I don't think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and I feel like that's such a good reminder for me, because there's times where I feel like I'm in over my head. But tell us about the stages. Tell us about those stages.
So the polyvagal theory lays out that, and this has to do with Fawn, actually, because you brought that up. It lays out that there are not just behaviors associated with potentially traumatic events, but there's actually biology. There's biological pathways within the autonomic nervous system. Mm-hmm. So when we say that, you know, flight, fight, shut down, freeze, we're not just talking about the behavior. We're talking about, in polyvagal terms, we're talking about the activation of those biological pathways that are unconscious. It's not a choice. It's a very much unconscious thing. And polyvagal theory lays out that there are three distinct primary states, just like kind of like primary colors is how I would say, like they just exist. And at the top of what we call the polyvagal ladder, at the top of the ladder is the safe and social state. Now, the safe and social state is not just like you feel safe, but it's also there's biology. There are specific biological pathways that are called the ventral vagal pathways that are active, which then result in behaviors that are associated with safety, like connection and being close with people and smiling. So there's that. And that's the top of the polyvagal ladder, is the safety state. underneath that is the flight, fight, sympathetic pathways. It's the sympathetic pathways. And it's flight and then fight when it comes to how we respond to dangers, flight first and then fight. And those pathways are, they exist distinctly from the safe and social state. These things do mix, of course, but if we think about it as three, as for so far, those two distinct pathways, safety and then flight, fight. And then at the bottom of the polyvagal ladder in the dorsal vagal, so again, it has its own pathway, biological pathways or circuitry, if you want to call it that, is the dorsal vagal shutdown system, which is this immobilization system. And all of these things evolved within mammals. Well, I guess all organisms, but mammals in particular have the safe and social state. We have the ability to be close and connect and form families and tribes and whatnot. So if that's unique to mammals, but all of these things evolved over however many years, millions and millions of years, I don't know, long, long time. All of these things evolved in order to increase the chances of survival. And the first one was that immobilization shutdown system. And then it became a little bit more complex over time. And the flight fight system or the mobilization system evolved. And then on top of that, at the top of the ladder is the safe and social system, which allows for being close and connecting and building families and whatnot. So there's distinct biological pathways that have evolved over time that are still within us day to day that kick on and off throughout the day, just unconsciously. Like, we're not really aware of it unless you slow down and really feel it and notice it. Like, you know, when you're parenting, which if you notice like, well, I'm really getting kind of escalated right now, my breathing is getting more shallow, that's that flight fight system coming online. So these things still come on and off all the time. Even when I'm doing like presentations, or if I do, sometimes when I do interviews, I'm in a pretty good place right now, but sometimes I get more like activated, like I get more energized, my breathing's a bit more shallow, and that flight system comes on, not enough to where I'm actually running out of the room, but it's there. Like I feel it, you know what I mean? But I'm able to smile right now. I'm in a good place.
Oh, good. Me too. That's awesome. Deb Dana named that, she said that there's two types of people that we seek out, and that's connection and support. Hmm. And that has helped me. Like, I mean, I was not viewing life in terms of three stages about 4 years ago. In fact, a year ago, I wasn't in this mindset. Yeah. So I didn't even know that. Like, I thought I was a captive of my emotions and my feelings. Right. I thought my body was just going to, you know, I had birthed 8 children and I felt like my body just knew what it was doing.
Right.
I was its captive. But now I find that, you know, those feelings that I would get overwhelmed with, like you said, you feel that you need to run, that's actually normal. Mm-hmm. And that has helped me so much, because for so long I've questioned my sanity, you know, am I crazy?
Yeah.
You know, when you're raised with people who accuse you of that for your whole life, you believe that. And this has been a breakthrough for me. I just feel like so many people could benefit 100%. Just from knowing that you're normal.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I think is the biggest, well, the most obvious benefit, the first benefit is just having that new narrative or that new paradigm, I guess, and realizing that, oh, it's not that I'm defective. It's that I have the same biology as every other human being in the world.
It's nice to hear that.
And we all have the same capacity to live in these different states and become stuck there. And that's not me being defective. Mm-hmm. It's just, oh, that's what trauma is, that we're just stuck in a defensive state. So it's not, when we say trauma, it's not really the event. It's what the event leaves us with. It's being stuck in a defensive state. And so I want to go back real quick, because you mentioned fawn. I left that hanging out there. So when we talk about safety and, well, we talk about the safe and social state, the flight, fight state, and the shutdown state, those have distinct biological pathways. The fawn thing, there is no fawn, as far as I know, there's no fawn biological pathways. To me, fawning in general is a what's called a behavioral adaptation, which means that we engage in some sort of behavior as a way to cope with being stuck in a defensive state. And I think Fawn could probably be a behavioral adaptation to flight, to a very severe flight fight, or even a shutdown state, or even a mixture of them. I wouldn't say Fawn is its own biological pathway. If it is, I don't know where that it lives. And to me, it's more of a behavioral adaptation, just like cutting is a behavioral adaptation to intense stuck defensive energy, or drug use could be as well. Or even things like little, you know, fidgeting and, you know, picking at your cuticles or grinding your teeth. These are minor behavioral adaptations, but they stem from some sort of stuck defensive energy that hasn't discharged yet. And so we engage in these behaviors as a way to kind of cope with it, I guess, is a way to put it.
Yeah. It is a coping mechanism then. Yeah. I mean, I remember doing it with my mother to keep the peace, and you know, my ex-husband, same thing.
Yeah,
you know, just to keep the peace. I don't give a crap what I have to lay down for this to just be peaceful. I'll do it.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's a way of getting needs met. It's a way of coping. I think it serves a very pretty specific function, but I think it's there for, you know, it's not like the person enjoys those things. It's not like it's a genuine expression of that individual's true self. It's a way of, I think, coping with and getting needs met, but there's other things going on in their biology that they're dealing with, and that's the best strategy they have at the time. That's kind of how I conceptualize it.
My therapist turned me on to your podcast.
Thank you, therapist.
Last year, yes.
Thank you, Nicole.
She was seeing how distressed I was with. I would find myself in the middle of just blurting out everything that was in my mind on my kids.
Mm.
And I would tell her, you know, here I was, I don't know what I just said. My kids are looking at me like, Mom, you know. And then I wanted to know what the hell is going on. And she said, you need to look up the polyvagal theory.
Yeah.
And it was like just, it explained it. It explained what was happening. I was running into fight or flight. Yeah. I was reacting rather than grounding myself and taking a moment to figure out what.
Yeah.
And I feel like this has helped me get to a place where I can start to get stronger each time and not react as much.
It's not an issue of strength, though, I don't think.
Well, flexing.
Sorry, I have a hard time when people say to be stronger. It's like, you birthed 8 children.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn strong to me. It sounds like you've been through a lot of stuff. That's pretty damn strong to me. Those little words that people throw out there, I get stuck on it, and I'm like, wait, hold on a second here. Mm-hmm. But
thank you. That's good though. It's got to keep in check.
Yeah, that's what
positivity works through. That
I like. Yeah. So you said that, you know, you wanted to know why, and I think that's so pivotal. Is being open to new information, and then your therapist, Nicole, saying, hey, there's some answers here. It's called polyvagal theory. And I do something very similar where the clients I meet with, I don't really just throw this out there, you know, session one. It's kind of like when I sense that they're at that place that you were, which is like, why is this happening? That's when I'm like, well, I do have an answer for you, and here's a whole new framework. But until that curiosity is there, I don't know how far it goes. You know what I mean? I think
that
people get really stuck on like, what's wrong with me and why won't this go away? And those sort of evaluative, judgmental thoughts and feelings. And when you're in that space, it's really hard to take in new information, especially if it's very normalizing and validating, which sucks because that's exactly what the person needs, I think. But I think you have to really be curious and open to what's going on within me? Like what I can figure this out, but I need to know first, like what the heck is happening within me?
I was just stuck.
Oh no, you're not.
You
not,
know, I was right. never broken. Right. Oh, it just, that was that's freeing right, yeah. for me. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Stuck, not broken. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was meeting with this 15-year-old girl, and she, I attempted to like give her this information. She wasn't really asking for it, but I attempted to give her the information of polyvagal theory. Just because I thought, you know, she was in this pretty deep depression. And I was like, well, maybe if I just give her this new paradigm, this might help with conceptualizing. And I remember her sitting in the chair. She was just completely slouched, basically laying down in this chair. And I gave her the information. and she was just completely unimpressed. And I'm like, seriously, like, this is like, this is the key to so much. I think, you know, learning more about ourselves. I was like, I don't know if I can give you any better information than this. And she goes, yeah, my dad says stuff like that all the time. Oh, God. Like, she just wasn't open to it, but I threw it out there. But I think that, like, you have to be open and interested, yeah, and really curious about, like, how can I do better and what's stopping me? And let me first understand what the heck's happening within me.
Right. I can't say enough about how I think that this, I mean, this is my fantasy, that we could give this information to police officers and
it could
change the whole way that they barge into people's lives, you know, and change.
For sure. Yeah, I did one presentation to police officers for our school. Our public school has its own police force. It's called District Police. A coworker and I, her name's Mercedes. She actually hosted the show with me for a while.
Mm-hmm. I love
her. But she and I, was that?
I love her too.
Oh, I know.
I miss her.
Yeah. She and I presented to a pretty large district police force, and they were totally open to it. They were really open to it. Police are a difficult bunch to like to lecture and teach to, but we were pretty engaging, and I think we got their buy-in. And we did hear some stories later on from a couple of them saying like they really had what we had in mind when they intervened in like a school issue, mm-hmm, and that it was really helpful. So I do think that this information and conceptualizing things in more of this way is a lot less demonizing maybe of the person who is going through something. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? So when they interact with, you know, the students or the teens or whoever, it's a different paradigm. And now it's like, oh, okay, this might not be a bad person. And I'm not going to assume that's what's on their mind, but it's like, this is a human being who is going through these different things, and it makes more sense now. And that escalation or control might actually make things worse. In some places, it's very appropriate. If people are flat out dangerous, it is appropriate. I'm not going to say it's not. But it did bring a new paradigm from what we heard from a couple of the officers. And it did affect how they intervened on a couple situations, which is for the better as well. It was more about relationship versus control.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, it seems that that's what we're asking the police to do is control right now. And I think more what we need is more like just more compassion and more support rather than, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the tough thing, though. Well, with police, like, and this is some of the feedback we got from them, was when you call the police, you're asking for control. Like, that's what they do, is we come there to control the situation, make sure everyone's safe. But to like, I don't want to say clamp down, but like, we're there to control the situation, and they will escalate it until the situation is controlled. And obviously that doesn't always go really well, obviously. But so when you call people in whose mindset is to control, like, that's kind of the way it's going to go. You know what I mean? Like, that's what they're seeking. Mm-hmm. They're seeking compliance and control. That's what it is. And so like I know for officers, like, we had done some research on police ahead of time and kind of the mindset of being a police officer. We really wanted to like make a presentation for them that was really going to click. And we had learned about some of the emotional preparation of officers and whatnot. And so for them, I forgot the name of the book, but there was this book that was written about police and their emotions and whatnot. And there was a section on hypervigilance. And for them, hypervigilance is a skill. It's a tool. So being acutely alert at all times and assuming the worst was a way for them to ensure their safety and survival. For us, being hypervigilant is something that we want to stop. We don't want to live in a very anxious, fearful state, right? So for us, that's like, we would call that like a mental disorder or something like that. We would say that we don't want that. For them, it's a survival skill. If they don't have that, that leaves them open to all kinds of stuff. And with the stories and the situations they've been through, they never know. They never know what's in the backpack. They never know what the situation is, you know, with the person. They have no idea. So hypervigilance is a skill. And when you ask them to like calm it down, in their mindset, it's like, you're asking me to lower my guard you're asking me to put my safety at risk. So it's a much different paradigm. The paradigm or the culture of policing is significantly different than just like day-to-day people, right? And it's a right. Like hypervigilance as a skill is so different, but also the culture. And what we heard from the people we presented to was that this is changing, but the culture of policing is not, you know, sit down and talk about your feelings and bond with each other.
No.
Not like that. Like they do have their own way of support and bonding, but it's not like a therapist would with another therapist. And as a therapist, I work with a whole bunch of therapists and we support the heck out of each other ad nauseum. Like it's kind of nonstop and it's sickening after a while, but that's what we do. And if you're, I think this is true for nurses also, for like EMT, for the police officers, like you don't exactly do that. You know what I mean? Like there is support. There's is understanding for them. What they said was humor is a way they cope, but it's not exactly that culture of support in the same way as it's a culture of support for like therapists. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's a neat way to see that. I hadn't even looked at it.
It's really interesting.
In that light.
It's so different. So when we put our own mindset and then we look at situations that involve police, for us, it's like, well, why don't you do this and this? And why don't you understand more? But for them, it's like, no, you're not out here day to day. You don't interact with these really horrible, random, highly, highly traumatic situations day in and day out. Like, it's a much different way of viewing the world. And if we can't see some sort of, like when we presented, we were well aware of like, we are not police. We don't know what they go through day to day. And we made it crystal clear. We are not here to tell you how to do your job, but we do think we have information on the mental health side of things that is important. So Our goal was to meet in the middle and say, look, this is what we're bringing to the table. And we know that you're the expert at your job, but we also know that we're the expert at our job, but there's definitely a middle ground here that we can talk about. And it ended up being, it ended up being a pretty interesting conversation. And Mercedes and I showed, like, we went on YouTube and found these clips of police situations that, like, went out of, to us, seemed to go out of control. And we presented these clips and kind of got their feedback into it. And we shared, this is what we're seeing. They shared, this is what they're seeing or what they could possibly see. And it was a really interesting dialogue. And it, rather than us going in there and saying, hey, stop doing this, do it this way, it was more of like, this is what we have to offer. What do you have to offer? And how can we meet in the middle? And we said, we don't know the answers. So it's such a huge cultural split of like police versus citizens, I guess, or non-police, I don't know what you call us.
Right.
But yeah, it's interesting. Civilians. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah. That I'm excited to see where that goes. I'd love to see like a peace force formed or some sort, something that, you know, have the police do their business and have maybe a backup team, trauma people, something.
It would make sense to have that, yeah.
Setup.
It could make sense. I don't, I haven't seen any therapists or social workers volunteering for that quite yet, but it would kind of make sense.
I'm working on it.
Are you okay?
I just want to interject here and say that I have a plan for a police force that's not police. It's peace police or peace force. And I think it's time we take a break. All right. So we're going to get back to the interview with Justin Sinceri now. Hang tight.
Just love about you is your love of music and how you tend to take a song and you'll play these clips on the podcast and then you'll explain the feelings that I just experienced without knowing I was experiencing them. I wasn't even paying attention to it. And suddenly I'm aware, so very aware of my vagus nerve. Mm. It's just like, oh, there you are.
Yeah. Right.
And there's been, it's so fun. It's exciting.
Well, and I think you're probably becoming more aware of not just the nerve. I don't think we feel the nerve, but you're feeling the pathways come to life, right? The safety or flight fight or the shutdown system. Yeah. You're feeling those.
And being more aware.
Right. And I think music is such an easy way, or excuse me, it could be such an easy way to feel these things in real time And I think it's a safe way also, but you have to mindfully listen. Like you really have to listen and be curious about like, what, how do I actually feel? How does my body actually feel as I listen to, you know, whatever song it is? And, yeah. And it tells you a lot. Like I like something called chill hop, which is lo-fi chill hop. So it's this like hip hop beat, but it has this lo-fi staticky kind of sound to it. And I listen to that pretty much anytime I'm doing work because it has a beat. And that, and when you have a beat, that kind of speaks to your sympathetic flight fight system. The beat keeps you mobilized. It keeps you bopping, right? But when you combine the beat with like a staticky, like a soft staticky noise or like nature sounds, that might activate for me, it activates my safety system. So I'm very motivated. I have the beat. I feel it while I'm working, but then I also have my safety system activated and I'm able to like really like laser focus and think critically and problem solve. So I have a nice combination. So that has a really nice impact on me. But also if you're in more of like a fight place, heavy metal, hip hop, like those things are going to speak to your fight system. And if you can listen to these things mindfully, you can really kind of tap into that system instead of just being angry. You'll actually feel like, what does it feel like to be angry or to feel powerful or to feel enraged maybe? Like, what does it actually feel like? And the music can help you to feel it without judgment too. It just helps you feel it, which is really cool. And then if you can mindfully do that, what I've noticed with myself is that if I can mindfully listen to music that speaks to whatever state I'm in, that it could actually help me climb the ladder up to the next polyvagal state. So I can go from my fight energy and listen to like some heavy metal and then feel like, okay, that I feel just like more calm, right? I feel the fight energy kind of alleviating. Now I feel like I can go up into like, listen to like Billie Eilish. Billie Eilish has very eerie, to me, like anxiety producing sounds. So to me, that's more flight energy. So I can listen to like Billie Eilish maybe. And then be like, all right, now I'm ready for, you know, go to the top of my ladder and listen to Etta James maybe. Like someone who has lots of vocal prosody and lots of safety in their voice and really kind of come back to the present moment. And so you can use music or even silence as a way to tap into your feelings and then climb your polyvagal ladder all the way up into your safety state.
I had a lot of attachment to music as a child and, you know, the transistor radio was in my pocket nonstop.
Really?
And I had it taken away from me and, you know, it was my mother was a zealot Christian and she said that the airwaves, the music was sending the horrible toxins into my mind, but I remember just the shutdown. That was probably one of the deepest ones and not having that music. And then my mom handed me this box of 45 albums, you know, the little tiny ones. And they were like Motown and the Beach Boys and Etta James. Okay. You know, it was just like all this old stuff. And I remember trying to listen to it, but it wasn't my music. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't what I loved. And so hearing that music, well, it has so much strength on that part of my body. Yeah. It's now I understand why.
Yeah, and there's things that we're pulled toward, right?
Yeah.
There's things that just sort of speak to our bodies in a way. And I think the music that we're pulled towards is probably the music that speaks to whatever state that we're in. Like we just like I think when we're in a very sad or depressed or disconnected place, we might want silence first off, but we also might be pulled toward music that matches that feeling, that emotional state. And
have you heard the Minecraft?
Oh music? Yeah. Heck yeah. We love Minecraft in my house. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the stuff that, you know, you get kind of melancholy. And if you hear that for me, I'm like, oh, I'm going to start crying.
That is, that's like the soundtrack of our house. My daughter's she's 11. She's way into Minecraft. My son, he's 5. He's getting into it. All three of us will sit down and play. And my wife just likes to hang out and be present and listen to the music. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It is kind of like that melancholy. It's gentle. It's soft. It's unintrusive. And it has little moments and sounds of safety. And I think, yeah, even if you're in a shutdown shutdown state, that music can really gently kind of bring you out of it, if you can, or help to gently bring you out of it. If you can really like mindfully be with it and experience it, I think it's perfect. Yeah, it's a really good way to come up your polyvagal ladder.
Yeah. I'll have to look up the chill hop.
Oh, yeah, you might like that.
I've stepped into the chill step. I love that stuff because I like dubstep a lot.
Oh, okay.
Do you like dubstep?
I'm aware of it. I haven't really listened too much of it.
Yeah, so it's got some
that's pretty intense, right?
Drops and it can get intense, but not too okay. often.
Yeah, chill hop. You might like that.
Oh my gosh. I will. I'm sure I will. I'm a music lover.
Just no country.
The same way. I don't know what it is, but that I listen to that and
it
feels like friction. Like it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, I feel like tearing up a wall or something. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it is, but that music does not speak to me at all.
Yeah, no, I can't do it either. Just feel like I'm not crazy. And
I don't think so.
There's that mindset that runs nonstop in a lot of our minds, that people who have been raised in trauma environments, where we question our sanity. And I feel that your podcast has helped bring me to a place of, I'm normal. Good. And this is a normal reaction. I don't have to react the way that I do and the way that I have. I can do things now that are like, one thing that you said, you had, if you have a situation where it goes differently than you had hoped, you'll kind of rewrite the ending so that you can handle it better, or so that it's a better ending and you don't have your whole day ruined. Is that, are you familiar with?
If I don't know, I've said a lot of things in the podcast. I don't remember that one in particular.
Well, I know my therapist has said to me, like, if a situation happened with me, say at the grocery store and someone was ugly to me, I could stew on that all the way home, or I could rewrite it. Sense. And that's something that I'm new to, and I know I've heard you say it before that it's something that you can do. I kind of idolize you for that because I haven't been able to figure it out yet. There's a part of me that thinks that I'm lying to myself and that would be bad.
To make up a new ending? Mm-hmm. I think that that kind of calls upon the power of like images. You know, when we use our imagination, it sometimes it feels like it's there. Like we actually, if we deeply imagine something, we have physical reactions to it, even though it's just in our mind, you know? So I think that like, or even memories, just calling upon memories, that it's not just the thing in your, it's not just the image in your mind, it's, or the words, your body comes alive based on what we have in our mind, or it can. And I would assume it's kind of the same thing when it comes to, you know, making a new ending, like your therapist is recommending. What you're doing is you're imagining something, and I don't know if your body knows it's not real. You know what I mean?
It was at this point in the interview that my jaw dropped, and I kind of just sat there for a minute. And if you can tell, our voices are sort of connecting at the same time. I think that Justin might have been really close to a nice satellite out in California, because here in Duluth, Minnesota, we weren't having such great connection. But back to the interview.
So I think that it's giving your body a different experience or outcome. I think it's also really important to actually, when you feel whatever it is, to let yourself feel it, like give yourself permission to feel it and invite it to like stay there with you if you can handle it, because the feelings are there anyways. So rather than ignoring it, you might as well welcome it and just say, hey, I see you, pull up a chair, you can hang out with me, but I'm also going to go, you know, do whatever I got to do. So rather than, because I don't know how helpful it is to like reject our thoughts or try to ignore it, maybe in the immediate, but over the long term, I don't think it's super helpful. And I would rather, and this is something I'm working on for myself a lot, is when I'm in more of that defensive energy. Like when I record a podcast, I'm not always like excited to do it. there's times where I'm like really nervous about the content and I'm like, I could easily just not record this, but, or posting to Instagram. I don't always feel very comfortable with what I post. And sometimes I just anticipate people are gonna get mad at me for whatever reason. And that energy is within me, that defensive energy, that flight energy. And so what I've been working on is like, it's okay to feel this way, let it be there. And I'm going to go do whatever I got to do to kind of build my tolerance to that energy, but also welcoming it and not judging it. So I think that in the realm of just like feeling what you feel and allowing it to be there, there could be a lot of value there in growing and building tolerance, but also success. Even though I feel this way, I can still do whatever it is and experience success. I think that could help to sort of reduce the intensity of some of those sensations as well. They're already there. They're already there. Like, how can you feel these and allow them to be there? Because they're already there, but also still function and like, and what that could look like for an individual. And that's going to be different for everybody. But I think the general idea could fit.
Yeah, it's something everyone can do with
little by little, working. Little by little. Yeah, little by little.
Yeah,
not all at once.
And it was not something I even thought I could ever do. Is step out of like say. A rant and go, hey, whoa, I'm just completely losing my head here. I'm going to go take a break and I'll be back later. You know, that's new. And my kids look at me and they're like, wow.
That probably means a lot to them. Like when kids see their parents consciously doing something different or changing the pattern or like catching themselves, they notice that. They really, really notice that. And I think it means a lot to them. And they don't, I don't think kids expect us to be perfect. I don't think maybe they hope, I don't know, but I think that kids are very okay with their parents being imperfect. And based on my time doing family therapy, kids don't really hold anything against their parents. As long as they see their parents like actively working to make change, they're very willing to say, I love you too and you're forgiven, and like, you know, to move forward, as long as the parent is actively trying to make change and saying, hey, I'm not perfect. This is what I'm actively trying to do. You know what I mean? Like kids are, I don't know. I think there's some leeway there. Not that it gives us permission to, you know, yell at kids and whatnot, but
they understand.
Yeah. They're like, we're just human.
I think they understand something called that unconditional love a little better.
I would think so. Oh yeah. Actually I would definitely agree with you on that one.
Yeah. They're so quick to forgive.
So that's why we have to be really careful, because there's a huge capacity to forgive, but they also need us. They rely on us. And that could be a scary combination. So there's a lot of responsibility on parents to really treat that with a lot of love and respect. So that we don't have to be perfect, but we also have to be mindful. And I think do the best we can. And that's, you know, that's a pretty fuzzy area, and hopefully people take that the right way. And no, I'm not saying like you have permission to yell at your kids 5 times a day as long as you know, regret it. Like, I'm not saying that. So it's like, but they're dependent on us. So there's a lot of responsibility that comes along with that, that we really have to, I think, honor and keep in mind.
I took on parenting willy-nilly thinking, oh, I could do this. Mm. This is easy. You know,
yeah, I haven't figured it out yet.
Not if you want to do it right. no, I'm figuring it out. Dang it. If you're patient and you put all the work in, that while they're smaller, it's not really as challenging, you know. It's probably like most work. You put all the effort in at the beginning, it can turn out real good, and we can just
ride. How old's your oldest child?
25. And then I've got an 8-year-old, and there's a set of twins in there.
So. Yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, if I lay the groundwork now, that this is the theory, that as they get older, yeah, there's still going to be challenges, and there definitely are, but hopefully those values and the especially the family connection, the love and the cohesiveness and the shared values, like if we can get that on board, I think that that'll really pay off later on in life. And I'm so happy to see that my kids genuinely enjoy us as a family. My daughter's 11. And this, when I was that age, that was when I started to pretty much detest my parents in every way, even though they didn't deserve it. But I mean, I really started to rebel. And so far, that the energy's within her, and I'm not going to fight it. I know where I get it, but she's still, it's still there, like the love, the connection, and the family you know, connection is still there, and I want to keep that going.
I think that's really important, keeping the cords connected and letting them know that we are their safe space. That's so important
absolutely,
to
yeah.
me. And my twins are both 11.
Oh, really?
Girls, so I understand.
That is it's so interesting to see her and to realize, like, wow, she and I used to hang out all the time. Like, we were like best friends. And to see her individuating and being more interested in her school friends and whatnot, it's really interesting. And so it's like there's a loss there on some level, but also now that our, you know, father-daughter relationship it turns into something else. And so seeing that unfold is sad in one way. There's some grief there, but also like curiosity and interest. And it's so cool to see her grow up, and I'm just amazed at who she is and expect the best of her in every way.
And so you should have pride in that too, then. Take some pride
For myself?
That, right?
Yeah, I guess
you deserve it. Yeah.
Well, my wife and I.
If you have a good relationship with your kids,
lots of positivity there.
I think that's...
Yeah, but it's cool to see, and I can't wait to see who she becomes, because she's pretty awesome the way she is, but yeah, can't wait. I also don't want her to grow up either.
Awesome. No, and I'm watching mine go from baby faces to little women faces, you know, and it's like, holy cow, you're growing into your teeth and you're wanting to try makeup on, and it's
oh my gosh, a whole new world. Isn't it weird to like, there's a part of me that does not want them to grow up, but also a part of me that's like, would you just hurry up and grow up? It's such a dichotomy that it exists at the same time, but both of those are true.
It's very like much. The yin and yang, the negative and the positive. Yep. Have you always been able to dole out consequences? Has that just been a parenting thing that you're just really good at? Or is your wife good at
it? I'm usually
too?
The one who takes that on. But she and I work really well together and have the same core values. And so we're very much on the same page. And if not, we openly discuss it and come to an agreement. But, I definitely use consequences. I'm not afraid to use consequences. And for me, it's for my 5-year-old, we use timeouts. And a lot of people don't like consequences anymore. They say timeouts are awful, but I just don't agree. And for my daughter, she's too old for timeouts, so we'll take away or remove like time, like screen time. Screen time is everything to her, so that's an appropriate consequence for her. But to me, it's like an absolute last resort, and they really have to earn it. This morning, she didn't earn it, and she was just like bugging me or teasing or something like that. I'm like, all right, fine. Well, you lost, you know, 30 minutes or whatever. And later on that morning, I went to her and I'm like, all right, that was stupid. I was just irritated. You don't deserve a consequence for what you did. I'm sorry. And we kind of talked, you know, I told her like, look, what you were doing was really driving me nuts. And, you know, that's that. So for us to use consequences, they really have to earn it. And because I don't want that to be my go-to. I do want, you know, open communication and all that stuff and problem solving to be the go-to. And for them to hopefully make the best of choices in the first place. But consequences I think are pretty important. And I think there's such a thing as too much consequences, but I also think such a thing as not enough. And I work with a lot of kids that get none whatsoever, but they also don't have the other pieces that parents need to be giving, like, you know, safe attachment, loving relationships, positive expectations, support. Like, they're also missing those pieces. So it's like, I don't know the right amount of all these things, but I think if you do the best you can with them, I'm assuming you'll end up with a pretty great kid. That seems to be the way it's going so far. My kids are awesome. But when it comes to consequences, I was trained in something years and years ago called the Parent Project. And I've loved it. It's a very, consequences are definitely a part of the program, but that is on top of like other things like praise and expressing love and listening skills, like all those foundational things. And then consequences are an option as well. and they lay out kind of what that looks like. And it's called The Parent Project. I liked it a lot. We did this intensive week-long 40-hour training in it years and years and years ago. And I've done lots of parenting groups or parent classes based on The Parent Project. And there's been some really, really strong results. Parents like it a lot. It's a different kind of paradigm to look at parenting. Because when we look at parenting, we assume that parents are supposed to have control and be in charge. And on some level, yeah, I do agree with that. But what The Parent Project explains is that your kids are individuals and they will make their own choices, whether you recognize it or not. They already do make their own choices. And my kids make their own choices. When my daughter was super young, I told her that, like, hey, you make your own choices, but you also live with the consequences of your choices. So The Parent Project is a good job of that balancing act, I think. And so I've been implementing that for years and years and years. And parents, I mean, just phenomenal results when they can faithfully implement, first off, the attachment love stuff primarily. And when they do that, they say, like, I haven't even had to use consequences. But when I do, the kids take it a lot more seriously. And so I hopefully that answers your question. Yeah, I think consequences are something that are very important, but requires a lot of patience in implementing as well. And that's where I think that I do have a leg up.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was from, family that was a get her done, right now, impatient, get the switch, whatever. It was, and I mean like a spanking stick, not like a Nintendo Switch.
Yes, thank you for that.
Yeah, and consequences weren't something I was familiar with. And then raising my own children, I was the same kind of way, where it was like, you behave now, and that kind of mindset, where moving into understanding consequences and being a kinder, more patient parent and loving and listening is probably the biggest thing. Cause I like to just tell them how they should be feeling. That's not right. But consequences, it's just simple. My 14-year-old was not getting it before, where I'd be like throwing a fit. These are the consequences. I throw a fit. Where now it's like the consequences are, oh shoot, the hotspot just got shut off. Means I didn't do my job. Oh no, I'm gonna go do that and go tell mom I'm sorry. So like it's so much, it takes a bunch of weight off of me. I'm not controlling them anymore.
Yeah.
I love it. It's
I think people are gonna hear that. No. And I think people are going to hear that and say, well, no, you are controlling them, but no, I'm not. And the way that The Parent Project frames it and the way I teach my kids is, we all live in this house, but this is my stuff. This is my Wi-Fi. I pay for this. I go to work for this. And when you use this, it's because you're either earning it or I'm just allowing you to have it. And that might sound a little, I don't know, totalitarian or something like that, but it's simply the reality of it. Like this is my stuff. This is my Wi-Fi. This is my electricity.
Yeah.
And you can use it as long as you're doing school and getting along more or less and doing your chores, have at it. Like there's not a whole lot of restrictions. We have some structure, but have at it. But as soon as you start breaking some fundamental basic things, like if your chores aren't done, if you're not doing school, if you can't get along, all this stuff that we allow you to have it's on pause. Like your life becomes a lot more boring. Until you can function. And kids can tolerate, if you yell at them, they don't like it exactly, but they'd rather yell back than be bored. And so when it comes to like timeouts and other consequences you implement, it's not about pissing the kids off. It's about creating boredom. Kids cannot stand to be bored. So when I remove my fun stuff, which are privileges, they don't have a right to Wi-Fi. It's a privilege. You're granted that based on whether or not you earn it. No one has a right to a TV.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have a right to water and food and shelter and clothes. But all the other stuff that you really enjoy doing, you don't have a right to that. That's earned. That's a privilege that is earned. So that's kind of the mindset around it. And when it comes down to it, it's like, you can choose to not partake in that. That's up to you. I will respect that. If you don't want to have Wi-Fi and tablets, that's up to you. And then she'll say to me, well, I saved up money and I bought the tablet, which is true. Well, she bought some of it. We paid for half of it. And I'm like, yeah, But you plug it into my wall and use my electricity, which I pay for. So you can keep the tablet. Once it's out of battery, you're kind of SOL. And it's not like a back and forth kind of thing exactly, but she needs to know that there are consequences for her choices. And right now, that is a realistic consequence for her, for choosing to not do the basic. Yeah. And we don't ask a whole lot out of them. Just do well in school. Do your basic chores. And we have a list for them every day of what they're supposed to do. Get along. That's pretty much it. You know, it's not a whole lot.
Right. With consequences. Yeah. I feel like consequences has you taking ownership, whereas getting in trouble has you ducking and running and trying not to get caught, you know? So it's just setting you up for criminal activity to have.
I can see that. Yeah.
You know, and it's.
Well, it's like, it's a thin, it's a very thin line. And I know there seems to be a move to like have no consequences. And if you can pull that off, awesome. I'm pretty happy with where we're at, where if you earn it, you're going to get a consequence. And it's not like we're hitting them. There's no yelling. There's no name calling. Like, none of that's happening. It's just like, dude, you didn't do your homework.
Right.
You don't get to do the fun stuff. That's it. You know what I mean? And that's the way it landed. Right. It's luckily like she gets the point. And so tomorrow let's try it again.
And it's a good, it reflects.
It does.
Reality. It does. You know, you can't go up and buy an ice cream cone if you didn't work and make the money for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of. I like that it.
I think it has to.
Life, you can use it, for the rest of your life.
Like it's we're training them in a way, like we're preparing them for real life, and that's kind of how real life is. If you don't earn stuff, well, in general, if you don't earn stuff, you don't get it. You know what I mean? And if you make dumb choices, you get in trouble. Like that's. Right. I'm not trouble, but there is a consequence for your choices, whether you call it trouble or consequences or whatever it is. Like there's a consequence. You know, if you do this thing, this thing might happen.
Yeah.
So that's what we do here.
Well, I think I'll be looking for little ways to make
boredom is it
for them.
Boredom is it. And as long as you as the parent can tolerate their boredom, they hate it. So as long as you can tolerate their boredom, whether it's through a timeout or removing their fun stuff for a very short amount of time, not ongoing, not for weeks, not for months, but like 1 minute per year of life for a timeout. That's what we recommend. And so 5 year old, 5 minutes, they can do 5 minutes of boredom. And my son can do it. Doesn't happen very often. And for my daughter, if we have to remove privileges, it's not for months. It's not for weeks, maybe a day. It'd have to be pretty severe. Like she'd have to have like not done her homework. And then it's like, all right, the rest of the day, like you're bored out of your mind. And then, hey, good luck tomorrow. You know what I mean? So it'd have to be pretty darn severe to go beyond a day.
Yeah.
And, but short periods of time of boredom, and kids hate to be bored. And as long as you as the parent can tolerate their boredom, it'll run its course. And what's funny is that there have been times where my daughter had like 2 or 3 days worth of boredom. And I forget what it was, but there was a couple things where it was like, no, yeah, you really earned this. And what's really interesting is when we took her away from all the fun stuff, and she was doing a lot of reading and writing and drawing. We love during these kind of boredom consequences, she can read or write or draw. Not on timeout for my son, but for her, she could have creative outlets. And when we take away the electronic stuff and the fun stuff that she gravitates towards, and we give her just creative outlets, she does a lot better. And she actually says like, I feel different. And so it's also a way to kind of like reset and realize like when I lose all the stuff that I'm really drawn toward, I actually feel better. I feel really like, honestly, I feel more connected to my family. I'm spending more time doing creative things. I'm reading. So there's a lot, and I don't want to like clamp down and give them just like an hour of tablet time. That's not really how we do things here, but she does get to learn the value of, you know, losing those things as well. And I don't know the right amount of tablet. I don't know the right amount of screen time. We just sort of like feel it out, and we have a structure they do follow, but sometimes it's like, yeah, we'll do more. And sometimes we'll just go outside and play instead of doing this or that. So I don't. It really is.
It's hard to know. Yeah. Right now with,
oh my God,
with this pandemic, we kind of just have to let go. We're just letting go. And
I think a lot of people are. And I think I was doing that at first, and it was like, they won't stop. If actually my son will, he'll do Legos. He loves to color. Like he can easily do without screen time. But for her, she's 11. Friends are very important to her right now. And so she doesn't have them. No one can come over. Mm-hmm. She can't go out. No one's in school. So all of her friends and her are doing Zoom,
right?
Just like chats. And they're always just sort of online with each other. Even if they're not talking, they're just sort of there. And so, yeah, it's sad in a way because they're just desperate to like hear each other and like be present in a way. So like that's their best way to connect. And I don't want to take that away from her exactly. But if I don't, and if I don't take away or have a structure for, you know, video games and YouTube and whatnot, then it won't stop. It'll be all day, every day. And I don't think she has the capacity right now to like walk away from that exactly. So that's where I was like, okay, this is out of control. Yeah, and that's when I started putting on very strict or more strict structure. And sometimes it fluctuates. But yeah, during the quarantine, like it's been, that's like her outlet. That's her way of connecting and getting relief.
I think that's ingenious. Yeah. They're figuring out how to do a Zoom meeting.
At 11. Yeah. That is cool. Yeah. And to be able to have that tech savvy is cool. But you know, I was talking with her about like, you're on this tablet, like a lot, you know, I'm not seeing you do a whole lot of else. And she's like, this is how I talk to my friends. What else am I supposed to do? And I was like, yeah, I didn't even think about it. And as an adult, I didn't think about it that way. But for her, like that is her way of connecting, which makes sense. And I see where she's coming from. So she and I will sit down and she's part of like discussing what the schedule looks like. And she's like, no, I want to have like an hour break here or 2 hours chunks here on my, you know, tablet or whatever it is. So we'll kind of negotiate about that. We'll negotiate about allowance and about what chores she does, stuff like that. So she has a lot of say so in all this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Giving choices.
It's a good life skill.
Really good. Yeah. Oh, I hope it was helpful. Every minute of this. Excited to share it. And I'm looking forward to your next podcast. I just noticed you popped one on today.
Every Tuesday.
So I'll have
every
to jump
Tuesday,
on that
yeah.
tonight.
You're welcome. Thank,
oh,
you,
thank
for,
you so much, Justin.
Thank you for inviting me on
it's
here. People
want to
listen
you.
To the podcast again. It's called Stuck Not Broken. And if they want to find, I have a whole bunch of content, not just the podcast, but at justinlmft.com. That's where I kind of, everything can be found through there. So justinlmft.com is where I have, it's like my main hub.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to taking advantage of that awesome program you have for subscribers. The anchors.
Yeah. Building safety anchors. That's my,
there we go.
My the course. Yes. Yeah. That one is, it's designed. Like I really want to help people become more in the present moment and safely feel what it feels like to be in the present moment, not have it be overwhelming. So yeah, building safety anchors is a way to figure out like what works for me as an individual. And I give there's some teachings in there, but also I help people figure out like, and it's a 30-day guided thing. So every day is small steps on figuring out like what works for me. And, just to become more in the present moment and feel more in your body in a safe way.
For coming
no
on.
No problem.
And,
thank you for inviting me.
Have a good one. Be well. Okay. And stay safe and social.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So there you have it. I didn't touch a couple of things because I didn't have the clearance and knowledge to do so. I honestly feel like I was inept when it came to saying anything about children do hold grudges and they can carry that into adulthood, because you know that is something that we do. We don't forget things, and if they weren't resolved, we will bring them into the future. So parents, definitely apologize to your kids. We have to. They need to know humbleness. They need to understand honesty. They can only do that by role modeling. And I just need to fess up here. Consequences. I mean, I've slammed them down a few times and they work really well, but I've been really bad at it, to be honest. And maybe you guys should just send me some power, because I'm really having a hard time not looking like the big bad guy. And probably a lot of this childhood trauma inside of not wanting to be the antagonist is a catalyst for me. And I don't think that's very healthy. I also noticed as I was doing a whole bunch of this editing that I am a stutterer, and I didn't even know that. So, wow. But I hope you had a great time. I know I sure did. I was shaking. I was just covered with a little bit of glaze of sweat. It was just like so exciting to get to talk to somebody who really knows their stuff and sounds like they live it. And those are my kind of people. I'm really excited to meet these kind of people. So I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope to make some more podcasts with some more awesome people. Stay safe and social. Dolly Mama. If you enjoyed the background music of the interview, in and out, there was some stuff popping in. That's some stuff that I'm working on the side. I'm having a lot of fun doing that, and I hope to pop that up onto SoundCloud real soon. I just want to say, please take a step over, go check out Stuck Not Broken. That podcast is chock full of goodies. Also, take a walk over to Justin. He's a licensed marriage family therapist. So Justin, JustinLMFT.com. That's a beautiful site, and there's a lot to see there. And I can't wait to get going on building anchors using his program. I haven't tried it yet. I'm waiting for finances to be good enough. Please love, subscribe, follow me, follow them, share with your friends. I worked really hard on this. I really want everyone to hear this news. It's great. It's life-changing. The polyvagal theory can stop being a theory now and just be the truth. Stay safe and social, guys. Your kids shouldn't be relieved to know you're not home. Your kids shouldn't have to double lock all their stuff because they're scared you might go through it. Your kids shouldn't have to think, here comes the screaming, or brace themselves for the worst because you're angry. Kat or Katie Woods from Twitter.